Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Welcome, everyone, to the Federalist Society's Teleforum conference call. As this afternoon, December 11th, 2020, we're having a Teleforum discussion on the implications and importance of CIC services, the Internal Revenue Service. I'm Nick Marr, Assistant Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that expressions of opinion on our call today are those of our experts. I'll be introducing our panel of three experts. I'll start with our moderator, Professor Robert Carney. He's senior counsel at Kaplan and Drysdale and an adjunct professor at Georgetown University Law Center. We're joined also as our panelists by Professor Kristen Hickman. She's Distinguished McKnight University Professor and Harlan Albert Rogers Professor in Law at the University of Minnesota Law School. And Professor Gregory Dolan is co-director of the Center for Medicine and Law at the University of Baltimore School of Law and an adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute. We're very pleased to have all of our panelists here with us today. And to the audience, we'll be looking to you for questions a bit later in the hour. So be thinking of those and have them in mind for when we get to that portion of the call. All right. Thanks very much for being with us today. Bob, I'll hand the floor off to you first.
Great. Thanks, Nick. As Nick said, on December 1st, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in the case of CIC Services, LLC versus Internal Revenue Service. That case involved whether courts have jurisdiction over lawsuits under the Administrative Procedure Act challenging the validity of Internal Revenue Service rules or regulations prior to lawsuits seeking recovery of taxes already assessed and paid. As you all know, the APA provides the normal procedure for challenging administrative rules and regulations. However, until 2011, in the case of Mayo Foundation versus United States, it wasn't clear, but the Supreme Court made clear that Treasury regulations are subject to the same validity tests as non-tax regulations. And as a result, also the APA standards must be met. In 2016, IRS issued Notice 2016-66, which Greg will be talking about a little later in more detail, basically imposing certain reporting requirements for micro-captive insurance transactions. And the question was whether the prohibition of the so-called Anti-Injunction Act, 26 U.S.C. Section 7421, on lawsuits, quote, for the purpose of restraining the assessment or collection of any tax, unquote, bars challenges to regulatory mandates issued by Treasury or IRS, such as the notice in question, that require reporting of information that could lead to the assessment of taxes but don't directly impose a tax. Ordinarily, tax regulations can be challenged only after the IRS asserts a deficiency or tax is paid and a refund is claimed. Here, the notice imposed significant compliance costs, which could never be recovered once they were incurred. Nevertheless, the IRS said in order to challenge the notice under the Administrative Procedure Act, you must first violate it and then incur civil and indeed possibly criminal penalties and then sue for a refund. So the court, obviously, some of the justices were somewhat concerned about that proposition. And so at this point, I'll turn it over to Greg to more describe in more detail what the notice was. And then Kristen can will talk more about the petitioner's positions.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you all for joining us, and thank you to the Federal Society for hosting this event and inviting me to speak. As always, it is a pleasure to join the Federal Society as well as this group of panelists that will be with me. So I'm not going to get into huge details about the notice, but just to give a bit of an overview. And so for those who are interested in learning a bit more about it, this is all in the government's brief, roughly on pages 2 to 7. But the basic story is that over the course of time, Congress and the Internal Revenue Service became concerned that there are some transactions that are engaged in for the purposes of no specific reason other than hiding income. And they have developed classification of two types of transactions. One is called listed transactions, which are basically everybody knows that these are just tax avoidance schemes and do nothing else beyond that. And those, those are treated as such. And then so-called transactions of interest, or TOIs, or TOIs, these are transactions that, could be engaged in for tax avoidance purposes, but could be engaged in for other legitimate purposes as well. And but of course, since the law evolved and human behavior evolved and financial sophistication evolves, there's no the list of these transactions also changes every so often. And what IRS did is they promulgated a rule saying that listing some of these transactions, but also saying that these transactions will include anything else that IRS might later declare to be a transaction of interest by any sort of written document, whether it by formal rule or by guidance or by some other method. And in this case, it was the guidance that IRS promulgated. So it was not a formal rule made with notice and comment or anything of that sort. And instead, so they promulgated a guidance specifically targeting transactions which are called micro-captive transactions. And again, without getting into huge details, the main concern is the transactions where a taxpayer pays to insurance premium to a company that is also controlled by the same taxpayer. And so it pays a premium to insure putative risk and makes this putative insurance payment and gets to exclude that payment from his own reportable income. And then because the recipient, the so-called insurance company, which may or may not be a true insurance company, gets to exclude the payment under a different provision of the Internal Revenue Code, thus making the money that's sloshing back and forth potentially not taxable at all. And again, some of these transactions may be entirely legitimate and some may not. And so for the IRS to know which ones are which, they've made a requirement that these transactions, the existence of these transactions, be reported to the IRS. And they backed up this requirement by penalties. And what's interesting in this case is that the requirement applies both to a taxpayer, so to the person who engages in these micro-captive transactions, as well as to anybody who sort of advises them. So financial advisors, banks, wealth managers, people, tax advisors, people like that who help structure these transactions for the benefit of taxpayer. And again, some of these transactions are entirely legitimate and people engage in them for entirely legitimate reasons, and tax advisors advise them for entirely legitimate and lawful reasons. But whether they're lawful or unlawful or taxable or not taxable, the reporting must be made. And so this suit was brought, and at this point I'll turn it over to Kristen, the suit was brought to challenge the requirement not so much by the taxpayer, but by these third parties entities who said that the requirement to collect the information to put it together into any sort of reportable document and ultimately report to the IRS is particularly onerous, and because no tax is due from them other than potential penalties for violating the reporting requirement, they should have a right to sue pre-enforcement. But at this point, I will turn over to Kristen to sort of to discuss what the objection is, and at that point, I will sort of come back and discuss what the government's response to the lawsuit was.
Thanks, Greg. And I, too, want to express my appreciation to the Federalist Society for hosting this call. So CIC services, as Greg suggests, Notice 2016-66 is basically looking for information. The IRS said, we think some, but we don't know how many of these kinds of transactions may be problematic for tax purposes, might represent abusive transactions. And so consequently, establish this third-party reporting requirement by labeling micro-captive insurance transactions as transactions of interest. CIC Services is a material advisor who helps to facilitate these sorts of transactions. And as a material advisor, under Notice 2016-66, was required to both collect and report information about its clients to the IRS. And if it declined to do so, these information collection information collection and reporting requirements are enforced by some pretty hefty penalties. And for that matter, as CIC Services pointed out, if it had to violate the notice in order to get to court, then it would be willfully violating the notice. And consequently, it would be guilty potentially of committing a crime. There are different ways of construing the taxpayer side of the CIC Services case. I filed an amicus brief in the case based on my 2017 Virginia Law Review article with Jerry Kerska, in which we argue that the best interpretation of the text and history of the Anti-Injunction Act would allow pre-enforcement judicial review of all Treasury and IRS rules and regulations, subject to other justiciability limitations like standing, finality, or ripeness. CIC Services took a much narrower position in this case, unsurprisingly. CIC Services focused particularly on the fact that the standard Anti-Injunction Act option of paying the tax and suing for a refund simply isn't available to it. Again, Notice 2016-66 imposes information collection and reporting requirements that are enforced by penalties, and for Anti-Injunction Act purposes, those penalties might be considered taxes. And they will only be assessed and come due if CIC Services first breaks the law to incur the penalties. CIC Services refuses to break the law. They emphasize that they are and want to be law-abiding. So according to CIC Services, it will never incur the penalty. So without pre-enforcement judicial review, CIC Services will never be able to challenge the validity of Notice 2016-66. Instead, it will have no choice but to continue to incur the cost of complying with the regulatory burden imposed by Notice 2016-66 year after year after year. And indeed, at oral argument, Cam Newton for CIC Services repeatedly emphasized that the IRS's interpretation of the Anti-Injunction Act would require CIC Services to commit a crime and basically violate Notice 2016-66 in the hope that the IRS would assess a penalty that CIC Services could then pay and seek to have refunded, which isn't going to happen, according to CIC Services. So also as part of its argument, CIC Services relied heavily on the Supreme Court's 2015 decision in a case called Direct Marketing Association versus Broll. Direct Marketing Association concerned a different statute, the Tax Injunction Act, which limits federal court review of state tax cases, but uses very similar language to the Anti-Injunction Act. The Supreme Court historically has construed the Tax Injunction Act and the Anti-Injunction Act very similarly to one another, recognizing that the Tax Injunction Act was patterned off of the Anti-Injunction Act and serves similar purposes. The court in Direct Marketing held that the Tax Injunction Act did not cut off a challenge to a Colorado statute requiring out-of-state retailers to report information regarding their Colorado customers to the Colorado Department of Revenue. So both the Tax Injunction Act and the Anti-Injunction Act speak of restraining the assessment and collection of taxes. In a response to a question from Chief Justice Roberts, Cam Norris for CIC Services emphasized that direct marketing defines restraining for this purpose not as an impediment to eventually assessing or collecting taxes, but more proximately as stopping the actual formal process of assessment or collection, essentially in process. CIC Services, according to Norris, has not even been threatened with assessment or collection yet because it hasn't violated Notice 2016-66. And it's really only challenging the validity of the regulatory burden imposed by Notice 2016-66 rather than anything that's more directly leading to penalty assessment or the collection of taxes. I think most people listening to the oral argument, and I'll be interested to hear if Greg perceives it the same way, but, you know, I came away with a sense that CIC Services is likely to win the case. A couple of the justices did express some skepticism, though. Justice Sotomayor seemed the most skeptical of CIC Services' position, I think, pointing out that the Supreme Court's 1973, I believe it was, decisions in Bob Jones University versus Simon and Alexander versus Americans United seemed to stand for the proposition that if a tax might ever be collected as a consequence of a Treasury or IRS rule or regulation, then the Anti-Injunction Act would bar a challenge to it. Also drawing from an amicus brief filed by a group of former government tax officials and authored with the assistance of several tax professors, Justice Breyer asked why CIC Services couldn't obtain judicial review by petitioning the IRS to pursue notice and comment rulemaking, and then if the IRS declined, challenging that decision under the Administrative Procedure Act. Norris responded correctly, I think, that challenging a denial of a petition for rulemaking under the Administrative Procedure Act is not the same thing as raising a procedural challenge against the validity of Notice 2016-66 for its lack of notice and comment. They're simply different claims, and the statutory requirements and the standards of review for each are vastly different. A challenge to a denial of a petition for rulemaking is evaluated very, very deferentially under the arbitrary and capricious standard, while a claim that a guidance document should have gone through notice and comment rulemaking is reviewed de novo. Justice Breyer seemed to appreciate that distinction, and I thought that he later pushed the government pretty hard to justify why someone should have to violate the law in order to obtain judicial review. But the mere fact that Justice Breyer explored the alternative means of getting to court suggested at least that he was not sold on the argument raised by CIC Services. On the other hand, Justice Kavanaugh, when he was a judge on the D.C. Circuit, wrote the opinion in a case called Florida Bankers Association, in which that court held that the Anti-Injunction Act barred pre-enforcement judicial review of a different information reporting requirement. In Florida Bankers, then Judge Kavanaugh distinguished the direct marketing case, and yet even Justice Kavanaugh seemed supportive of CIC Services in the oral argument. In this case, he started out his questions by observing that the penalty for violating Notice 2016-66 would be a tax for Anti-Injunction Act purposes. He contended that direct marketing is distinguishable because the penalty in that case was not a tax, unlike the penalty in this case, as a statutory matter. And he maintained that the Supreme Court's 1974 decisions in Bob Jones and Americans United pose a problem for CIC Services. Yet, Justice Kavanaugh then suggested that Bob Jones and Americans United should not be read for all they're worth, and that the court ought to back away from some of the implications of those cases for challenges to regulatory taxes for the reasons offered by CIC Services, most notably that it's unfair to ask a party to violate the law in order to obtain judicial review. Justice Kavanaugh's question for CIC Services was how best to do that. He even broached the possibility of flat-out overruling Bob Jones and Americans United. So because of his opinion at the D.C. Circuit and Florida Bankers Association, I have long assumed that Justice Kavanaugh would be a solid vote in the IRS's favor and CIC Services. So the fact that Justice Kavanaugh seemed open to making an exception for regulatory tax penalties or even flat-out overruling Bob Jones and Americans United was truly striking. Most of the other justices in questioning Cam Norris for CIC Services seemed more interested in trying to figure out how to draw lines to allow CIC Services' suit to go forward. Justice Thomas wrote the court's opinion in direct marketing, so it might not be too surprising that his question seemed supportive of CIC Services' position, allowing Norris to emphasize the parallels between the two cases and the fact that not only has CIC Services not violated Notice 2016-66 itself, but an amicus brief filed by several state captive insurance associations declared that industry representatives were not aware of any captive insurance provider who had violated Notice 2016-66 or incurred any tax penalties under that notice. Justice Alito specifically asked Norris when a challenge to an IRS regulation would be barred by the Anti-Injunction Act. And here Norris suggested that the Anti-Injunction Act would cut off judicial review when a violation has occurred and a penalty has been assessed or would imminently be assessed, at which point the challenger would be in a position of paying the tax and suing for a refund. Justice Kagan asked about whether the narrow equitable exception to the Anti-Injunction Act recognized by the Supreme Court in a case called South Carolina versus Regan might apply in this case. Norris didn't quite say yes or no to that question. At least CIC Services has never framed its argument as purely being about the applicability of South Carolina versus Regan. And Justice Kagan suggested that CIC's case is different from Regan in a couple of ways. One, that there was a constitutional claim in Regan that is missing in this case, and also that South Carolina had absolutely no other way to get to court, whereas at least in theory, CIC Services has the option of committing a crime. Norris acknowledged those distinctions. But Justice Barrett was also interested in the possibility of applying South Carolina versus Regan and suggested that it might be cleaner to acknowledge that the Anti-Injunction Act applies, but that if the only way you can get to court is by committing a crime, then you have no effective remedy available to you, and perhaps South Carolina versus Regan ought to apply to allow that equitable exception. So again, you know, just sort of parsing through the justices, I think that CIC Services is going to have enough votes to win the case. To me, the question is how narrowly the court will carve the exception how the court will interpret the Anti-Injunction Act to allow CIC Services' case to go forward. This case could be a first step in expanding judicial review of pre-enforcement challenges to tax rules and regulations, or it could be a narrow exception that at least rhetorically seems to close that door for most tax rules and regulations. But we haven't talked about the government's response yet, or the questions that were asked of the government. So for that, I'm going to turn it back over to Greg.
Thank you, Kristen, for that comprehensive review of both CIC's position and the court's reception of that position. So the government's response, and before I actually get into it, let me kind of make a disclaimer here. At the beginning of the call, Federal Society always says that the views expressed here are just of the experts, and it's true as far as it goes. And though I've agreed sort of to talk about the government's position, especially given the fact that Kristen filed an amicus brief on the petitioner's side. Having read the briefs and oral argument, I tend to actually agree more with the petitioner's position of the government, but I will do my best to represent what the government has actually tried to argue with the court. And I will also say, before sort of going further, that I think Kristen's reading of the tea leaves is correct, that it seems that the court was more receptive to the CIC's position and the government's. But with that out of the way, let me sort of recapitulate what government was arguing and how that argument was received in the court. The government's argument is actually very straightforward. The government argument proceeds as follows. Number one is that the requirement to report is unlike, for some potentially other requirements that are enforceable by criminal penalties only, the requirement to report is first and foremost enforceable by a monetary penalty. And point number two, that Congress has in the Internal Revenue Code defined these types of monetary penalties as a tax, which then gets to point number three, that because this is a tax, it falls squarely under the prescription of the AIA, of the Anti-Injunction Act, which cannot be restrained by a pre-enforcement challenge. So it's a fairly straightforward syllogism. The ultimate pushback to the government was the question of whether or not this is really, even though Congress defined it as a tax, whether or not this is really a tax. And kind of Justice Kagan, I think, got to that point most clearly. when she asked the government, isn't it true that the tax here is entirely derivative of the reporting requirement? In a sense that usually, and so Justice Thomas also sort of hit that issue as well, that usually we pay taxes on some sort of economic activity. You know, you go to work, you make money, you pay taxes on it, and you may disagree that you are not allowed to take some deduction. And so you can sort of argue with that point with the IRS. And the rule is generally pay the money first and then go to court to get the money back from the IRS. Potential with interest, if you are correct about how certain deductions or certain tax, rates should apply to you. But here, as Justice Kagan pointed out, the tax has nothing to do with any sort of economic activity by the advisor. So maybe this case would have been argued very differently if it was the taxpayer who's engaged in these micro captive transactions were to bring it. But the advisor here is not actually engaged in any taxable economic activity. And so the only reason taxes could be assessed is because of the failure to report. And so that was kind of really picked up by the Supreme Court. So like I said, Justice Thomas hit that issue. Justice Kagan did. Justice Breyer, who, as Kristen pointed out, was initially at least exploring some alternative avenues of resolving this issue, such as asking why hasn't CIC brought a petition for rulemaking and then appealed the denial of that. Justice Breyer also suggested that one of the problems that CIC is facing is that they're required to engage in this transaction, in transaction meaning in the collection of information and submission of information and spend a bunch of money, or the alternative is to violate the law and potentially be liable for fairly significant penalties. And this issue is also heavily explored, the issue of that the penalties can be actually fairly heavy. And the ability to pay may be compromised. The government's response was, again, fairly straightforward, saying that the precedent has held that the fact that you may not be able to pay the fee or the tax is somewhat irrelevant to the application of AIA. And so additional government said that what agents like CIC could do is they could pay part of the fee as opposed to the entirety of it because the penalty is divisible and then sue for a refund of that part with the government having to cross-claim for the remainder. And that way, at least initially, the material advisor like CIC would not be on the hook for, multi-millions of dollars. Of course, if the CIC loses, then that all they've done is postpone the inevitable and still would be on the hook for a significant amount of money. Even Justice Sotomayor, who I agree was the most hostile to CIC, even she explored this issue that part of the problem that CIC is facing is that if they wish to comply, and CIC expressed several times during oral argument that in addition to wishing to avoid being penalized by the IRS, in addition to wishing to avoid committing a crime by willfully refusing to provide the information, they also have professional reputation to uphold. They don't want to be known, according to CIC, as a company that flouts IRS regulation or doesn't follow them for some reason, because that will look bad for them with their competitors and with their clients. Nobody wants to seek financial advice from a company that basically doesn't know what it's doing and it gets constantly hit with fines by the IRS. And so that's another reason that CIC brought up. And Justice Sotomayor kind of explored that as well. Said, look, they don't want to spend all that kind of money, which even if they're right, they will never actually get back. So their choice is either to be wrong and potentially be on the hook for significant penalties or spend hundreds of thousands of dollars that they may not have to spend because they were actually right that they don't have to do it, but because they can't do pre-enforcement challenge, they will be forced to do it. So, and then the other question from Justice Alito were concerned kind of the last point that Kristen brought up was about this whole willfulness issue. The government represented to the court that merely disagreeing with the IRS and refusing to follow the requirements, as long as you notify the IRS that that's what you're doing, that you have a good faith disagreement, that it's not some sort of crazy conspiratorial theory, that you have a good faith disagreement, is not a willful violation. So, you know, according to the government, you can file, basically, CIC could merely send a letter to the government saying, look, we're not going to do this. We know that your position is different, but here's all of the reasons we don't think we have to compile this information. And so go ahead, assess your penalties, and then we'll take you to court. You know, we'll pay the penalties, and then we'll take you to court to get the money back. And according to the government, that if that's what the CIC does, sure, they might be on the hook for penalties, but at least their failure to submit the documents, the requested information, would not have been willful and therefore would not be criminal. It would be just a civil matter about whether or not you ought to pay taxes or not. And Justice Alito didn't buy, certainly the question betrayed his skepticism of that argument. He suggested that when the kind of requirement is clear, that what there's something that you should do as a legal matter, and if you just refuse to do it for whatever reason, that sounds very much like willful violation of the law. And so government provided some potential line drawing methods where such behavior may be defined as non-willful, but it's not clear that the court, or certainly at least Justice Alito, was buying that argument. So that's, I think, how the argument went. One issue that I kind of wanted to raise is that it seemed a little odd to me. So I'm, full disclosure, I'm not really a tax person. I do a bit more of an admin law side than purely tax. And so one issue that kind of seemed relevant to me, just brought some flashbacks, as of the case the Supreme Court decided a number of years ago, I think maybe 5 years ago by now, called Sackett versus EPA. And in many ways, the situation there was similar. In Sackett, a number of landowners, the Sackett family, they wished to do certain things on their land, and EPA told them that they can't, or if they do, they'll be hit with significant penalties up to tens of thousands of dollars a day. And Sackett brought a pre-enforcement challenge, to which EPA responded that you can bring a pre-enforcement challenge because there's not yet a final decision by a governmental agency. So you have to await final decision, exhaust your administrative review avenues, and only then can you seek judicial review. And Supreme Court unanimously rejected that. I think it was unanimous. It rejected that position, saying that you shouldn't have to risk complete financial ruination in order to challenge what might very well be unlawful government actions. And it was somewhat odd to me that that analogy was not made. Now, granted, this was a different context. This was pure APA as opposed to Anti-Injunction Act. But it seems sort of the logic of Supreme Court and kind of this equitable exception that was explored by the court with both EPA and the government seems to fit very nicely with this sort of presumption of pre-enforcement review, which Chief Justice Roberts was hinting at, that there should be a fairly significant presumption of pre-enforcement review before subjecting the taxpayer or a citizen to significant government penalties. I don't know if this analogy would make it into the final opinion or not, but it just struck me as a little bit odd that I never really made it into anybody's brief or questions at oral argument. But the bottom line, I think the government's position is appealing in its sort of simplicity, because it just kind of, it goes these 3 points, boom, 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 where it's like, this is it's enforced by a penalty. Congress defined the penalty as a tax, and taxes cannot be enjoined before collection. But I think that simplicity of the argument hides serious problems, which the court identified about the Hobson choice facing material advisors like CIC, where they have to either risk their professional and financial well-being, or potentially engage in a very expensive conduct of collecting and reporting information that they are not legally obligated to do. So, and if I get, like I said, if I were to guess, and it's always foolish to read, you know, coffee grounds of based on the oral argument, but if I were to guess, I would suggest, I would think that the court would find a exception to the ban on pre-enforcement challenges, would reject government position that would allow these this regulation to be, or this notice to be challenged as not having been properly promulgated and not therefore imposing any legal responsibilities on the petitioners.
You know, Greg, you raise a really interesting point about Sackett versus EPA and finality. I will say, just generally speaking, other justiciability limitations like finality and ripeness and so on, you know, the all of the things that sort of come from Abbott Labs and cases stemming from there regarding justiciability in the tax context, there's a real paucity of those sorts of cases. We just don't have very many of them because of the Anti-Injunction Act. The Anti-Injunction Act has been, you know, sort of the justiciability limitation of first recourse in the tax context. And, you know, because, you know, the Anti-Injunction Act has gotten in the way, the court hasn't had a lot of opportunity to analyze other justiciability limitations. They just don't come up that often. Depending on how the court interprets the Anti-Injunction Act, I think we'll see more cases going forward about finality and ripeness, and as well as standing, you know. But certainly when you're talking about a notice, an IRS notice, there are questions about finality. There's a lot of variability in what notices do and the kinds of burdens that they impose. Certainly this one, by imposing penalties, probably makes for a much easier finality analysis under cases like Sackett or Bennett versus Speer, you know, than maybe some other notices might. So that might be one reason why finality hasn't really been raised as an obstacle. I think it'd be a real, I think a finality argument would be a real loser for the government with respect to Notice 2016-66, you know, as compared to the Anti-Injunction Act argument that they raised.
Kristen, and I agree with that. So my point was not so much that this is or is not a final decision, or,
yeah,
you know,
sure,
the government should have made
that.
It's more about when our challenge is proper and whether or not these rules that we generally, you know, generally view as a good system that does keep the courts somewhat constrained in excess of their jurisdiction, because federal courts are, of course, courts of limited jurisdiction, whether these rules are as inflexible as the government's, like I said, fairly superficial appealing position makes them out to be in this case.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Supreme Court, at least in Sackett, said that they're not, that there are these, whether you define them as a, you know, as an equitable exception or just as a textual exception based on kind of on the meaning of the word in context, that or due process exception. So I think Supreme Court said that you shouldn't have to require a citizen or a, you know, a petitioner to risk complete financial ruin and potentially going to jail before you allow them to challenge government's potentially illegal actions.
Sure, absolutely. And that's a sentiment that the Supreme Court has embraced going back as far as Abbott Labs versus Gardner. So it'll be interesting to see how they reconcile that instinct, I think, that they have in favor of pre-enforcement judicial review with the text of the Anti-Injunction Act in this case.
If I could jump in one second, I think, Kristen, I'd like to get your views as well on points that Greg raised, which seemed to me when I was listening to the argument as somewhat maybe concerned by the government about the potential extreme, justices potentially reviewing it as a somewhat extreme position. You have to violate a penalty involving significant, very significant penalties and or criminal violations, and they came up with this divisible, maybe it's like a divisible tax, which if you're, you know, like certain excise taxes and others can be challenged, and as Greg was saying, and then by paying the tax on one item and then having the government counterclaim, and the concept of sending a letter, oh, by the way, I'm violating this law, but it's not willful because I just told you I'm going to, and whether it seemed to me that they were kind of, in that respect, making it up as they went along, because they, and not really being maybe that much concerned about how many different ways that could come back in other contexts. But I'd like to get your reaction as to whether, you know, you thought they were also sensing some concern about this when they threw out that concept of, well, this could be a divisible tax. You know, you'll just, you know, just violate it once, like $50,000 worth or something, and then challenge that and let the government, and maybe only violate it just with respect to one return or something, not with respect to a lot, and maybe then just challenge it in that context, and whether the government, whether the IRS would even assert. Then you had to rely on the IRS cooperating and asserting the tax on that one violation. So what's your thought? I mean, do you think that divisible tax and write the government a letter, I'm about to violate the law, was really foreseeing the concern that several of the justices expressed on the government's position in that regard?
So if I'm,
no,
if
I mean, oh, so go ahead.
So I wanted to go first on this one, because precisely because I am not an expert in tax, and so I can give my kind of this unvarnished, almost layman's reaction, and then, you know, have Kristen tell me why I'm wrong, or perhaps confirm why I'm right. And so, to be honest, I didn't really understand that argument at all. To be fair, I also didn't understand the CIC's argument saying, well, maybe the government will never penalize us, so we have to get sued now, because my response, again, as a layman to it, is like, well, if you don't get penalized, then who cares? Right? So keep doing what you're doing. But this argument about divisibility of tax just seemed very weird to me, because it doesn't actually answer pretty much anything, in my view. So if the government is saying that, look, CIC, you're advising 100 different clients, collect data and submit data for 99 of them, don't do it for one of them, and then we will just be subject for whatever, $50,000, $200,000 in penalties, and that's not that much, and then if you're right, we'll even get that money back, and then in the following year, you don't have to collect information for any of the 100. For any of the 100 clients. But that doesn't answer the problem that CIC said, basically twofold problem, that A, they'll still be known should they lose as a bad financial advisor who doesn't know what it's doing with respect to, you know, government regulation. Or two, that if they're right and they actually win, then they've just wasted however many thousands of dollars collecting data for the, you know, 99 other people. And of course, it also doesn't answer the objection that, you know, the $200,000, I think it's up to, actually could be potentially more because it's a percentage, but up to $200,000 in penalties could be a significant risk. And again, I don't know how big CIC company is. Maybe they're a multi-billion-dollar advisor, but maybe not. And so it doesn't answer the question that just because you violated once, that somehow doesn't, you know, expose you to significant financial and professional risk. So that argument didn't make any sense to me at all.
Well, it made sense to me in a couple of different ways, although I don't find it especially persuasive, at least. You know, so one thing I will say is there have been instances in the past where, you know, there's disagreement. The one in which I'm most familiar with it is an excise tax type situation, where rather than having to pay, you know, if you really don't think you owe millions and millions of dollars in excise taxes, you know, that are imposed on every single sale, you know, pay it on one tax. Sure, if you lose, you're eventually on the hook for having to pay it all. You know, if it's a $5 tax, let's say, you know, or a $50,000 tax even, you know, if you pay a little bit now, if you lose, you're going to have to pay the whole thing. But while you're litigating, you know, and you'll have to pay it with interest, but while you're litigating, your money isn't tied up, right? You've got the liquidity still. You know, of only having to tie up a small amount of money in order to get into court. And I've seen situations where somebody will pay, you know, a small amount of tax in that sort of a way, you know, where it's divisible in that kind of a way, and they can just pay a little bit now in order to almost kind of like an agreement with the IRS, as the IRS suggests, you know, so that they can get into court and they can litigate it with the understanding that if they lose, they'll have to pay the tax with interest in the long run. But in the short run, they're not tying up their funds. whether that, you know, but usually those are civil cases, not criminal ones. And it's, you know, you're not talking about having to violate a statute in a way that is, you know, where you you know, you're trying to generate that regulatory penalty that, albeit we label as a tax for Anti-Injunction Act purposes, you know, you're really talking about just trying to manage sort of the cash flow of the whole thing. You know, the other thing, though, that I think was interesting about it is in the civil context, there is a provision. So when, you know, if I, as a taxpayer, somebody who owes income tax, if there's some regulation or some rule that I think is just wrong, you know, I can file, you know, my tax return with a, there's a specific form the IRS has where you can literally flag for them, hey, I'm reporting my tax liability not in compliance with this rule or regulation because I think the rule or regulation, you know, is wrong, is not, it exceeds statutory authority or something to that effect. And at a minimum, filing that form at least gets you out of being assessed penalties for noncompliance or for underpayment of taxes. It serves as a big red flag. Hey, IRS, come audit me, come issue a deficiency notice so we can litigate that. But it's at least an option that's available. But that's in the civil context. And again, I don't, you know, it, that reg is in the under, you know, that form, I think, generally relates to underpayment of taxes, not information reporting requirements. So, you know, exactly how realistic the proposal that the IRS was making at oral argument, I really question how realistic it is.
Right.
And this kind of a case.
And I think ultimately it gets to this notion that, again, so Justice Kagan explored what the government is, and the government tried to actually press this issue, but I think Justice Kagan sort of flipped it on them. The government position was that the key issue in Anti-Injunction Act is, what is the purpose of the suit? Is the purpose of the suit to enjoin collection of taxes? And the government's point was, because ultimately the notice is backed up by penalties which are treated as taxes, in essence, in reality, what the suit is trying to do is to enjoin collection of taxes. But Justin Kagan suggested, and I think this sort of dovetails with what Kristen was just saying, that this is not so much about tax. It's actually that the purpose of the suit is to enjoin really the requirement to spend money on collecting information, and that the tax is entirely derivative. And so in that sense, the example that Kristen gave about so excise tax, that actually does make sense to me. Because, you know, you sold 100 widgets, you think that these widgets, for one reason or another, are not subject to excise tax. So, okay, you're going to pay tax on one of them and going to withhold on 99, and that gets you an opportunity to get to court to litigate and IRS to cross-claim. But the point is that if you're wrong, your taxes was due all the time anyways. Whereas here, there was no taxes due ever unless you actually both violated the reporting requirement and the government chooses to assess tax in whatever amount that on that sort of sliding scale they can. So, yes, so this whole divisibility point makes sense to me as a general matter, just not in this context.
Sure. Although I will make the observation that, you know, both at the D.C. Circuit with then Judge Kavanaugh writing in the Florida Bankers Association case, and in the Sixth Circuit, I think the majority of both of those circuit courts basically took a, you know, because they concluded that penalties are taxes, they really kind of took a too bad, so sad, strict interpretation of the Anti-Injunction Act approach to the case that does put the taxpayer but does put a material advisor with a reporting requirement like CIC Services into precisely this position. To some extent, I think one aspect of this is, do you really think of this? You know, we have this tradition in administrative law of pre-enforcement review. Admittedly, Congress can make exceptions from it. But do you want to think of the Anti-Injunction Act as creating that sort of exception from a norm of pre-enforcement review? And that's such a strong norm in the administrative law context, I really do think it's going to be interesting to see whether the court, you know, since I think that CIC Services will win, will the court decide that it's going to carve a very narrow exception, for somebody just like CIC Services, where the only way to get to court, or the perceived only way to get to court, is by, you know, essentially violating the law and potentially opening yourself up to criminal prosecution, you know, or are they going to try to find a way to interpret the Anti-Injunction Act to reconcile it more generally with that notion of pre-enforcement judicial review in a broader sense?
So I think we may be ready for questions.
Yeah, I think those are all good points. Nick, you want to open the floor?
Yes, thanks. And Bob, I'll hand the floor back to you. We don't have any questions right now.
Oh, good. No questions so far. That's great. Again, I thought the issue of divisible tax was also a very good one, and also the issue of South Carolina versus Regan, I thought deserved maybe just a little more comment, because for those of us who are old enough to remember South Carolina versus Regan, the South Carolina filed an original suit because of trying to issue tax-exempt bonds, which at the time, if they were denied tax-exempt status by the IRS, you couldn't sell them. So their position was, it was not just that you would incur some small penalty or that there would actually never be a taxpayer who would end up paying tax on those bonds, because the bonds could never be issued without a tax-exempt ruling. So South Carolina versus Regan perhaps was a more absolute bar on being able to litigate in a post-enforcement mode. Here, it's more of a question of being able to find the vehicle. One, of course, being the criminal barrier is one, which wasn't present in South Carolina versus Regan. But the divisible tax thing, I felt did not address the problem in South Carolina versus Regan, or I should say, brought them pretty close to the same situation as South Carolina versus Regan, where you actually couldn't get a post-enforcement form. Do the other panelists feel that way?
You know, I mean, as I mentioned before, you know, I mean, I think that there are both sort of analogous aspects to South Carolina versus Regan and also distinguishable aspects. You know, South Carolina versus Regan also involved the constitutional question, and this case doesn't. And I will point out that the court historically has construed the South Carolina versus Regan exception from the Anti-Injunction Act very narrowly. This is not something they've sought to apply expansively. So the fact that South Carolina versus Regan involved a constitutional question brought by a state, which often, you know, states carry a certain special status oftentimes in these sorts of cases, that South Carolina had absolutely no avenue to get to court other than, by making an exception to the Anti-Injunction Act. Those do make this case a little bit different. On the other hand, you know, one of the things I think that was really concerning to the justices was, you know, whether telling a business, you have to commit a criminal violation, you have to commit a crime in order to be able to get to court, whether that really ought to be considered a viable option. Should we think of that as a circumstance in which CIC Services really doesn't have an avenue to get to court, you know, maybe a roughly theoretical one, but certainly not a practical one, that, you know, we should consider, you know, appropriate. I think that was the import of Justice Barrett's question to CIC Services in particular. It would arguably be an expansion of South Carolina versus Regan, but there's a certain tidiness to that in some ways. Okay, the AIA applies, but we've got this slightly broader now equitable exception, rather than trying to draw lines, for example, about what the word restraining means. In terms of temporal proximity to the assessment or collection in question. Of course, anytime you get into equitable exceptions and you start expanding equitable exceptions, then that becomes its own sort of fuzzy challenge, right, of line drawing. So, I don't know whether they'll go that way or not. I will point to one question asked of the government by Justice Justice Gorsuch, observing that you know, that the APA was promised as a solution to the growing power of administrative agencies over the national economy, observing that tax regulations, you know, cover all kinds of activities in the economy, from, you know, medical care to pensions, the nonprofit sector, the education sector, childcare, so on and so forth, and observing that the IRS does not have a tremendously great track record of compliance with the Administrative Procedure Act, you know, that at least, you know, and then Justice Thomas's comment, you know, or questions about direct marketing association, you know, I think that there are at least some justices that are open to the idea of trying to interpret the actual text of the APA rather than just expanding the South Carolina versus Reagan equitable exception, but I don't know how the justices that seem favorable to the IRS break down between those two alternatives.
Yeah, I think those are all good points. Go ahead, Greg.
No, I had nothing to say.
Nick, Bob, if I can jump
I was just going to say those are all really good points. And one point of administrative law that is in here does not directly implicate perhaps the Anti-Injunction Act or when you get the review, but whenever you get the review, for those interested more in the administrative practice side of this, the so-called transactions of interest, or TOIs, TOIs, all tax lawyers like acronyms, that basically the regulation just says, oh, it'll be these things will be whatever or substantial transactions or substantially similar transactions that we put out in further guidance. And so this was like a notice. This was a notice that was issued pursuant to a regulation, but the exact violation of it, you're not directly violating the words of a regulation that have been promulgated under the APA. You're violating a notice that was issued under an open-ended regulation that says, plus whatever else we say later in guidance that's not promulgated with notice and comment under the APA. So that's just a thought I thought people should have in mind as we're getting toward the end of this, or if anybody has any other questions on it, because it throws another wrinkle into this that was not really much of an issue in the case.
Right, and I think
Nick was trying to let us know that there was a question.
Oh.
Yeah, that's
is that right, Nick?
We do have an audience question. Yep. Thank you very much, Professor. So we'll go to it now and try to get it in before the hour.
Yeah. Hi. Thanks for taking my question. I just wanted to know what the applicability here might be for these hybrid civil criminal statutes where, you know, it's one thing if you don't want to pay a tax, but it's another thing if you're, let's say, in the firearms industry, if you violate the law there, the look is much worse. You are, you know, potentially a really bad person, I guess I'll say, in the eyes of the law. How does this argument, or how might this argument apply outside of, you know, a pure tax context?
Sure.
It really depends on, you know, how broadly or narrowly the court construes it. So obviously taxes are somewhat unique because we do have that Anti-Injunction Act. There's no anti-gun, you know, regulation litigation act. But obviously government, this is not, like I said before, it's not the first time government has tried to limit people's ability to come to court, as was with Sackett, where they said, like, look, you can't bring any challenges until there's some sort of final action. So I can imagine a situation, I don't know how successful it will be, but I can imagine a situation where, for example, the income administration comes up with some rule, say, on, you know, bump stocks or the magazine sizes or, you know, calibers of the guns or whatever, and it threatens people with, you know, variety of penalties for not complying with some, say, very onerous reporting or storage or some other requirements. So perhaps not outright banning them, but sort of making it just very difficult to own them. And then when sued, sort of being responding saying, well, you can't sue us because there's not a final enforcement action. So basically break the law first, then we might come after you, impose some sort of civil fines. Then you have to appeal through whatever administrative process we have. And only then you might be able to go to court. I don't know how successful it will be, but, you know, obviously the more you know, solicitous, the court is of these sort of limitations on its jurisdiction, it could bleed into other areas. But I think at this stage, my reading is that this is somewhat of a tax-specific context until we get to what Bob was talking about before. So if the taxpayer wins here, then the secondary question is not actually, they don't actually win on enjoining the statute. They would only win on being able to get to court. And the secondary statute is, what is the authority of the IRS to impose legal requirements through just notice? And I think that creates so much more interesting issues about, about the reach of the administrative state and what kind of people can and cannot, and government can and cannot do.
I will make a couple of additional observations. I mean, I do think because this is a tax code specific provision that we're interpreting, there is an extent to which it's at least possible that the court might, in construing that Internal Revenue Code specific provision, may speak in a way that this case doesn't have a lot of broader applicability. But it's also possible that they could speak more sweepingly. I think that, there's always in administrative law been this civil criminal distinction, or at least for many years there's been a civil criminal distinction where we treat the two kinds of cases differently. But I think that there's become a heightened awareness in about the last, 10, 15 years about just how expansively these hybrid regulatory statutes that are enforceable through both criminal and civil penalties, how many of them there are and how expansively they apply to people. Certainly that's come up in the Chevron context and opinions by Judge Jeff Sutton of the Sixth Circuit, and also it's been debated in the academic literature. So it's possible that they could end up saying something broader in this case that, might weigh in, to how we think about those hybrid regulatory statutes. One last thing I will point out, too, that I think is worth emphasizing and that might distinguish this case from some others, even in the tax context, is here we are not just talking about paying a tax. We really are talking also about a reputational harm. It's hard to overemphasize how being branded a tax shelter promoter is detrimental to your reputation in the financial services industry. They don't want to be labeled as a tax shelter promoter. That's going to hurt their business separate and apart from any sort of criminal penalties that they face. So that does make this particular case a little bit different even from a lot of tax cases. So that may have some influence too in terms of, the reach of the eventual reasoning that the court puts out.
And I think that's exactly why they've said on multiple times to the court saying, look, we're never, like, however this comes out, we're never going to break this regulation. We're never going to, we're never going to risk and, try to get into the court through incurring the penalties. We're just not interested in doing that, not because perhaps we can't afford to pay, but because of these other concerns. And I think that the questioner was getting the same thing. Like, if you're, say, a gun dealer, are you going to risk being known as the gun dealer who sells, guns unscrupulously? And, most of them will say no, they're not going to risk that.
So, Bob,
I think we're pretty close to the end of the program, unless anybody has anything else they want to throw in or any other questions. Otherwise, I will turn it over to Nick.
Great. Yeah, I was just going to offer a chance for closing remarks, but we've exhausted our time. Well, lively discussion. Thank you all for joining us. And on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank you, our experts, for the benefit of your valuable time and expertise today. And to our listeners for calling in, as always, be checking our website and your emails for announcements about upcoming teleforum calls. We have another one coming up here shortly, so tune back in for that. Thank you all for joining us this afternoon. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleform, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.